It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we talk to the host of a Swiss folk music show in Monroe for the last 60 years about the Swiss community in Wisconsin, what she's going to do now that she's retired.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Voters went to the polls in Washington yesterday to vote in the state's Republican and Democratic primaries.
And protesters clashed with police outside of a Donald Trump rally in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And, of course, we'll take your calls in just a little bit at 800-642-1234.
Harry Enten's back with us. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538, and he joins us every week to talk about news from the campaign trail. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So the state of Washington had primaries for both Republicans and Democrats yesterday, and Trump walked away with the win. Now, this at this point, this is not a shocker, right?
Considering that all the competitors to Donald Trump dropped out, I would say it was not a shocker. I mean, you know, he's running against nobody. So, you know, you'd expect him to win, and he did that, and he won rather convincingly. And he should be able to officially clinch the nomination on June 7th. But he's already got it.
So now catch us up. June 7th, what happens?
So on June 7th, you have a whole bunch of states that are voting, New Jersey, California, New Mexico, South Dakota. But basically what we expect is Trump is so close to the delegate mark right now. He's you know, less than triple digits away. He should be able to clinch as soon as the polls in New Jersey close. I would expect that the networks, that's the earliest date that closes that evening, I would expect the networks to declare him to be the Republican nominee for real.
And now moving to the Democratic side of things, Hillary Clinton won in Washington, but it's kind of an unusual case there. This is not going to help her that much. Tell us why that is.
Right. So Washington, like Nebraska, are two states in which the Democrats allot their delegates via caucuses that have already happened. But then the state, which runs primaries, remember, it's parties that run caucuses, states that run primaries. The state individually or separately from the party ran a primary yesterday, and Hillary Clinton actually won that primary, but there are no delegates that are allotted to the primary, which stinks if you're her because she lost the caucus by 46 percentage points, and she's right now winning the primary by 7 percentage points.
So what's going on there that she would win the primary but not the caucus? Is it just that the national mood is saying that, look, Hillary is the presumptive nominee, so why vote for Bernie?
Yeah, I think there are a few things that are going on here. I think number one, which is very clear, is Bernie Sanders likes to argue that when turnout is higher, he does better. But in fact, we can look at the past math, and we know for a fact that's just simply not true. Hillary Clinton actually does better when turnout is higher. She does about, on net, about 20 to 25 points better in primaries than she does in caucuses. That's the effect of a primary versus a caucus. But I would also say that, of course, in Bernie's defense, that the state was uncompetitive. There wasn't really any campaign activity going on going into the primary yesterday because it was a quote-unquote beauty contest, that is, no delegates being allotted. And then finally, I would note that, yeah, Hillary Clinton has gained a few points in the national polls over Bernie Sanders, and perhaps some Democrats are saying, you know what, the gig is up, let's rally around Clinton.
So, you know, aside from that gig is up moment, as you put it, does she get anything else from winning Washington? Just bragging rights at this point and showing that perhaps she's got some momentum going?
Right. I think, you know, with bragging rights, I think, you know, Sanders has consistently tried to say, or his supporters have tried to say, that the game is rigged. And I think there's nothing less rigged than a primary in which all of the votes are cast by mail. That's literally how it is in Washington. Every registered voter receives a ballot by mail, and all you have to do is drop it off in the mailbox. This is something even my dead grandmother could probably do at this point. And so, you know, it's very easy to vote, and Clinton simply was able to win when it was easy to vote, which I think goes right at the heart of Sanders' argument, that is, that this game is rigged, that they're keeping people from voting. In fact, Washington allowed pretty much everybody to vote, and Clinton won, and won by a significant, she did significantly better than she did in the caucus.
So let's look to June 7th. Is that also a magical day for Hillary Clinton, and how early in the day do you think she could have this locked up?
Yes. Essentially, you know, if you look at the delegate totals right now, and if you look at where the Associated Press has it, they basically have her about 80 delegates short of, including superdelegates, of where she needs to be in order to clinch the nomination. And New Jersey, should put her over the top on the basis of the fact that it has 126 elected delegates at stake. She's going to gain some delegates from the Virgin Islands and the Puerto Rico primary that are coming up over the next few weeks. So New Jersey, even if she only wins, say, 40% of the vote in New Jersey, and she should do significantly better than that, she should be able to clinch a little after 8 o'clock Eastern time.
Well, you got it down to the time. 8 o'clock.
Of course. Remember, I have it down to the time. I'll probably be drinking a diet orange soda. I know exactly what's going to be happening.
What are you going to be wearing? I guess we'll have to wait and find out.
Who knows? You know, it depends. Am I in my own apartment or somewhere else? If I'm somewhere else, I'll be dressed much nicer.
We're talking to Harry Enten from 538, looking at the latest in national politics. And Harry, you know, we're talking about Hillary Clinton. You say she's going to clinch this nomination on June 7th, but Bernie Sanders is not necessarily seeing it that way, and he says there's still going to be a contested convention, and you even concede this in your piece. You said, well, yes, there may well be some element of that. Why so?
Well, essentially what it is, Hillary Clinton will not have enough elected delegates. Those are the ones, you know, that we go into the voting booth and elect. She will not have a majority of the total delegates if you just look at the elected delegates. That is, she needs the superdelegates to put her over the top, and superdelegates are not elected. But I really should point out that it is the normal procedure of the television networks, the major news organizations, to count superdelegates towards the delegate total when determining whether or not someone is a presumptive nominee. They did the same thing 8 years ago with Barack Obama. Barack Obama did not have enough elected delegates to have a majority of all of the delegates. They added in the superdelegates, and they're going to do the exact same thing this time around with Hillary Clinton.
No, Harry, I know you're very active on Twitter, and you call it like you see it based on the numbers, and one of those things is calling it so far for Hillary Clinton as the nominee. Do you see any change in the tone from Sanders supporters, or are they thinking that there could still be a viable chance and looking for something to happen at the convention?
No, I see the same insults in my Twitter feed every day that I see from Bernie Sanders supporters. I don't think that they've really changed their tone at all. I mean, you get called immoral one day, you get called another name another day. And no, I don't think there's been any shift in the tone. And I think that's a potential real problem for Hillary Clinton going forward, is she needs Bernie Sanders voters in the general election. And right now they are not with her. And that's going to be the big question going forward, is can she capture them? If she can, she's a heavy favorite in the fall election. If she can't, I don't know what might happen.
So what about independents? We hear about the importance of independents and, well, swing voters too, but how does Hillary match up against Bernie Sanders when it comes to independents?
So this is actually a really interesting thing. So if you look at the exit polls that have been done so far in the primary season, and they've run their course because the networks believe there's no reason to pay for exit polls anymore because Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee. If you look at the exit polls, though, you see that Bernie Sanders does much better among those who identify as independents, while Hillary Clinton does much better among those who identify as Democrats. However, and this is the big however, is it turns out that most people in this country who identify as independent are actually really aligned with one party or the other. And in fact, if you go back over the past few election cycles, you see those people who say they're independent but then say they lean towards one party vote overwhelmingly for that party's nominee. So if you look at the Democratic leaners, those are Bernie Sanders' camp. But if you look at the people who say, no, I actually don't lean towards a political party, Bernie Sanders has a favorable rating among them, according to Gallup, of only about 35%, which is not very much higher than Clinton's 34%.
And we're going to switch tracks here a little bit, look at a Trump rally last night in Albuquerque. And this was a time where protesters turned violent. There was some action there going on the ground. What do you think about what happened and what that might mean for where the Trump campaign is right now?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that this is going to be an ugly general election. Donald Trump says a lot of things that upset a lot of people. Hillary Clinton does the same, but I think that a lot of people feel much more threatened by Donald Trump, whether it be his statements on women, on Latinos, on African Americans, and so on and so forth. And so you see what's going on in Albuquerque, which is a state, New Mexico is a state with a lot of Latino voters in it. He tries to hold a rally over there because New Mexico is holding a primary on June 7th. And, it's just a very ugly scene. And Trump says a lot of things that are ugly. And the people who don't like him also then decide to ratchet up a notch. I think it's, you know, you say one thing, I'll say another, and at the end of the day, what ends up happening is you have this vitriolic ball that just explodes in the rallies or in the protests outside of the rallies, and it's very ugly.
But he has been softening his stance, hasn't he, especially since he emerged as a presumptive nominee?
I mean, he softens his stance in some ways, and then the next day he tweets out a photo of him eating a taco salad and claims that that's outreach to Latino voters. And, of course, most Latino voters would not see that as outreach if for no other reason than the taco salad was not, in fact, invented in any foreign country. It was invented by some guy in Southern California. So, you know, this is what Donald Trump does. He says one thing one day and one thing the other, and it's like trying to pin Jell-O against the wall. So far, it's worked for him, but I think that there are a lot of people who take his words very seriously, and that's why you see what you saw in Albuquerque yesterday.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now, checking out the latest from the campaign trail. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see out of the upcoming primaries, the last round of them, of the conventions this summer? And it's looking almost certainly like a Clinton-Trump general election. Will you fall behind your party's candidate or your preferred party's candidate? Are you excited? Are you enthusiastic about this race? Are you excited in a good way or a anxious way? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And right now we're continuing our conversation about the presidential primaries that are underway throughout the country and the presidential race in general as the presumptive nominees continue to look like they're closing in on those locks, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And we want to know what you think. What do you think about the campaigns? Have you chosen a candidate? Was it your first choice or was it not? Will you fall in line with that person from your party? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send your comment to talk@WPR.org.
Harry Enten stays with us. He's senior political writer and analyst at 538.com.
And we'll take a caller now. We have Deontay from Madison. Deontay, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I was just calling to respond to the question I heard before the ad came on, was if my candidate of choice doesn't grab the nomination, will I fall in line? I happen to be a Bernie Sanders supporter, and honestly, I don't under any circumstances ever seeing myself voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. So no, I won't be, even if, I mean, like I said earlier, anyone with half a mind can see that Hillary Clinton has this thing in the bag. So
Deontay, would you just abstain from voting in the presidential race? You'd vote in the other down ballot items, or would you just stay home on election day?
I honestly, like, I was thinking about doing what everyone else is doing. I don't know if you guys are aware of, like, the hashtag that's trending all over Facebook and social media, Bernie or bust. Everyone's saying that they're just going to write Bernie in. But if you get a bunch of people to do that, then you're just basically splitting the Democratic vote. And you might as well just be handing Trump the victory. So I don't know. I'll probably just abstain from voting this year and hope everything works itself out.
And Deontay, I'm curious about this. So what if you saw Hillary Clinton's campaign pick up on some of the main talking points that Bernie Sanders has been running on? If you saw her incorporate that and make an effort to reach out to you and people like you who support Bernie Sanders, would that sway you?
Well, actually, that's kind of funny you bring that up. I don't know. I mean, me personally, I think since this primary really began, that Hillary Clinton has slowly began to, like, notice these things that Bernie Sanders says to people and see if she sees the passion that it ignites in people. And she has slowly been adopting some of his talking points. And I saw, I don't know how long ago it was, within like 2 months ago, Bernie Sanders actually brought that up himself about how he's noticing that she's starting to take some of his talking points, and honestly, I don't believe that it's sincere. I think she's honestly just picking up those talking points so she can pick up the votes. I don't know if she necessarily agrees with the talking points that she's adopting now.
All right, so you're not believing it. Still skeptical there, Deontay. And Harry, so who is going to get the Bernie Sanders vote? And if Hillary Clinton is picking up on some of his main platforms, will that influence anybody, do you think?
I think your call, the caller, in talking through it, you can see how Bernie Sanders supporters are almost split in some way. They clearly do not like Donald Trump, but they're clearly upset with Hillary Clinton. They don't like a number of the things that they stand for, but they, at the same time, they don't want to split the Democratic vote. If you look back to 2008, there were a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters who were very upset. There was this Puma movement of Clinton supporters who said they would not support Barack Obama as the Democratic nominee, and he ends up getting more than 90% of the Democratic vote. Does that mean that's what's going to happen this time around with Bernie Sanders supporters? No. But I think if, you know, Bernie Sanders comes out and endorses Hillary Clinton, and if you see Clinton make outreach to the Bernie Sanders community, she will get most of those Bernie Sanders supporters. Not all of them, but most of them.
Now, we haven't talked, you know, VP rumors yet, and maybe this is still premature, but is there any chance of Clinton picking Bernie Sanders as a running mate?
Probably not, for any number of reasons, but I will say that there is an increasing chatter that she could, in fact, perhaps select Elizabeth Warren, who, of course, was who a lot of people who are now supporting Bernie Sanders initially had wanted to run. They share some similar ideologies. Elizabeth Warren, obviously, very harsh against the banks. She's a very liberal senator from Massachusetts. So that's a potential possibility, and it's possible that Clinton believes that she needs to shore up her base. And so I would not count out Liz Warren, although Bernie Sanders seems a lot less likely to me.
Elizabeth Warren didn't want to run for president. People were trying to draft her to run. Why would she run for VP?
Because it's a lot easier to accept the nomination and be put right on at the final level of the game than have to work through 50 primaries and 50 whatever number there are primaries and caucuses. Running on the presidential campaign is kind of tough. It's the same reason that, for instance, Al Gore decided not to run in 1992, but then was more than willing to accept Bill Clinton's nomination to be vice president.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now from 538, looking at this year's presidential election. And we're going to go next to Becky, joining us in Beloit. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I just wanted to see what you guys thought about my thought that I think Donald Trump, although he says a lot of hateful, racist, terrible things. I wonder what you think about what a lot of people may not say out loud, but really sort of believe some of what he's saying or agree with some of what he's saying. And do you think that that's getting quiet voters to sway to his side? And sort of, you know, whether they would say it or not.
Becky, thanks a lot for that. Harry, what's your take?
I think that Donald Trump certainly does speak to a number of people with his beliefs that most people would believe would be politically incorrect, and that's why they've rallied to his side. I think that's definitely the case, but I would argue that the polls, separately from that, I would argue that the polls do pick that support up, which is part of the reason why I think you've seen a coalescing of the Republican vote in a number of the national polls and why he's closed the gap with Hillary Clinton. I would say that most of the people who hold those beliefs that he that secretly they might hold are already going with Trump. The question is going to be whether or not the center of the electorate, the pure independents, whether he's able to get them on his side. And right now he only holds a favorable rating, according to Gallup, of 15% with those truly in the center of the electorate. So that's going to be the real question going forward.
And Harry, you mentioned tightening between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and I know that there are some national polls coming. I think some, maybe one from ABC. But what are you seeing in terms of a matchup between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
It's tight in the national polls. It certainly is tightened. I think the average has Clinton up by about 2. There are some polls that have Trump ahead, which is what you would expect if the average lead was about 2. You mentioned the ABC News Washington Post poll. The Fox News poll is another one that had Trump ahead. But the question is going to be, we already have seen Trump capture the Republican nomination, coalesce that Republican support. What happens when Hillary Clinton officially captures the Democratic nomination, whether or not she is able to coalesce that Democratic support? If she is, her lead will bounce back up from about 2 to 5 percentage points. If she doesn't, then we've got a very interesting ball game on our hands.
Right. And broadly, like, when should we start caring about the polls in terms of that general election matchup?
I would say there are really 2 points. One is after Clinton captures the nomination, but in all, realistically, I would wait until after the conventions. That's when the polls get a lot more accurate. So tune probably in about early August That's when both of the conventions will be done, and we should get a fairly good idea. If one of the candidates holds a large lead at that point, they're probably going to be the next president of the United States.
And Harry, just briefly, is this stalemate between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, is that hurting the Trump campaign at all, or hurting Paul Ryan on the other hand?
It doesn't seem like it's really hurting Trump. He's, you know, his poll numbers have gone up. He's coalesced Republican voters. Paul Ryan, on the other hand, I don't know exactly what he expects to get out of this unless he truly is never going to endorse Trump. If that's the case, then he's taking a stand. But otherwise, he's just delaying the inevitable and really isn't keeping any Republican voters from going over to Donald Trump.
Harry, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, and he joins us every week to talk about the latest news from the campaign trail.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Swiss folk music radio host who just retired after 60 years on the air here in Wisconsin, in Monroe, in fact. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're listening to Martha Burnett yodel in a 1967 recording of Come to Cheese Days in Monroe. It's a song used to promote the annual festival in Monroe, Wisconsin, called Cheese Days. The festival celebrates Greene County cheese and the area's Swiss culture.
Earlier this month, the Swiss-American community in Monroe said goodbye to their on-air relationship with Martha Burnett. She aired the last broadcast of her Swiss folk music show, which she had hosted on WEKZ in Monroe, 6 days a week for 60 years.
The station's homepage calls Martha everybody's Swiss sweetheart. She grew up in Switzerland and moved to Wisconsin as a young adult. Her last broadcast was on May 11th, which was also her 60th anniversary of doing the show.
Martha Burnett joins us now to talk about her time behind the microphone, what it was like growing up in Switzerland and moving to the United States, and what she's going to do now that she's retired. Martha, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm honored to be on the show today.
Well, I'm honored. As a radio person, I understand you did the show for the most part 6 days a week for 60 years.
For 60 years, yes. That's a lifetime.
It is. What was it like doing the show so long and so regularly?
Well, I really don't. I guess I was lucky. In the beginning, I had to go to the station once a week to do it, to tape it. It was reel-to-reel at that time. And the records were 78s, and I had to go and tape them. I had to go to the station once a week. And since we had a store, that wasn't so bad because we were open 7 days a week. So I just went out every Friday morning, and I chose the records ahead of time, so it wasn't really that much work. And I announced the records in the Swiss language, and then I said it in English. I translated the what I played in Swiss first, and then I translated in English. And that's how I... Actually, I didn't start it. There was a man that did it first, and then he had a real bad car accident, and he asked me if I would do it, and I said, I can't do it. I never did anything like that. And he said, you could talk Swiss, and you could talk English. That's all it takes. And so I started.
Why was it important to you to share music from Switzerland with your community?
At that time, here in Monroe, if you opened the telephone book, 80% of the names were Swiss. And when you walked around town, especially on a Saturday, when people went to town, you heard nothing but Swiss language. And so I kind of felt maybe they would like to keep the Swiss music and alive. And they enjoyed it so much. They told me, keep it up, keep it up. And I know before we did it, there was a program from Madison, from the university, on a Saturday afternoon. And Emil Schaefer did it, and he played Swiss music. And everybody said, oh, we have to go home now. The Swiss program will be on. So when the Monroe opened the station, then they felt they should do some Swiss music too. And it was a big hit here then. So that's really how it started here in Monroe.
And for the people, you said so many people there were Swiss in Monroe. How important was it having that radio show that was a tie to their culture?
Well, there were a lot of them here that came here earlier, like in the 20s and 30s. And for them to hear Swiss folklore music again, it made them kind of close to Switzerland again, because a lot of them were very homesick for the mountains, and they couldn't go back anymore because they didn't have the money. So they kind of felt close to Switzerland again when they heard the Swiss folklore music.
Now, you moved here to the U.S. in 1947, I think, from Switzerland. And did you feel homesick when you got here?
Very much so, yes. I was very homesick in the beginning. Very homesick, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was...
I missed the mountains, too, mm-hmm. and the lake, because I came from a beautiful part in Switzerland.
Where were you from in Switzerland?
I was from a little town called Leisigen, but it was close to Interlaken, which a lot of people, even here in the States, knew already. And Interlaken was between two lakes. And I went to business college there. And it, like I said, it was just a beautiful place.
We're talking to Martha Burnett, host of a Swiss music program on WEKZ in Monroe for 60 years. She just wrapped up the show earlier this month. And Martha, we have a lot of lakes for you here in Wisconsin, but no mountains. I'm sorry. Did you get used to living in a place where you didn't have mountains all over the place?
Well, I mean, there are places in Switzerland, too, we call it the flatland, too, that they don't have mountains. But there's always mountains in the background. Mm-hmm. Where here, I could go, just walk around and walk around, but there were no mountains to find.
So you played music on your show, but I understand you also brought your accordion to the United States from Switzerland. Do you
yes.
still play accordion?
Unfortunately, I cannot play my accordion anymore because I had some back surgery, and that finished my accordion playing.
Well, I'm sorry. The accordion is a very heavy instrument. I've held them, and I wonder how people hold them so long.
Now, my accordion is not that heavy because it's a diatonic accordion, and it's a smaller one than the piano accordions. It has buttons on both sides. So it isn't that heavy, but still, it's heavy, and the pushing and pulling is what's to work.
Did you?
So I had to give it up.
Did you just play on your own for yourself, or did you perform on the accordion?
I used to perform. I used to, but not anymore.
And you used to sing, too, with the Edelweiss Stars, I think, in New Glarus.
Yes.
About your singing career.
Yes, with the Edelweiss Stars, I actually sort of fell into it because one of the girls lost her voice completely, and she couldn't sing for at least 6 months, and they had to appear in quite a few places at that time. So they asked me if I would fill in. They knew that I from just listening to them, that I knew the melodies. And so I had to, within about 3 weeks, I had to learn 30 songs.
Wow.
So I had to do a lot of work, and I have to admit, some of the words I just kind of, I just pretended I knew them.
But nobody caught you?
Nobody caught me. Nobody said anything anyhow after we did the concert.
Well, getting back to your radio show, I understand that recently, now with the computer and the internet, you've been finding out people are listening to you not just in the Monroe area, but around the country. Is that right?
Yes, that all at once when we went worldwide, I got through the internet. I had people listening in San Antonio, Texas, and I got and St. Louis, and from the West Coast, and from the East Coast, and even Switzerland. That was funny. When my nephew from Zurich, when he sent me an email, and said that enough is enough. We can hear you when you come to Switzerland, but now the turn you on over the internet is a little bit too much.
Too much? I thought that would be great, wouldn't it? They could hear you whenever they want.
They chuckled about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Wisconsin's a little different now. We don't have people walking around speaking Swiss as much. Do you see some of the younger generation at least being interested in the music, keeping some of the tradition alive?
Well, you know, there are not that many Swiss in Wisconsin anymore. After the 1962, when the McCarran Act was signed, that meant the Swiss, not just the Swiss, but the West European, couldn't come in here in Wisconsin to work. They could come for 6 months, and then they had to go again, unless they had they worked at something that, like a nanny or somebody that had did some special work. They could stay, but otherwise, no, they couldn't stay anymore. And naturally, that meant that there are not that many West Europeans working here anymore. And unfortunately, there aren't that many people that speak the language because they couldn't stay anymore. Mm. That was, in a way, it was sad because we don't have that many like Swiss people here anymore.
And Martha, you've retired from the show, but I understand you are still very busy. You've got a lot keeping you busy now?
Oh, I'm still busy.
All right.
You know, after you've done it so long, you can't just quit everything. You have to stay busy.
Martha, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
That was Martha Burnett, host of a Swiss music program on WEKZ in Monroe for 60 years. Her last broadcast was on May 11th.
Coming up, we talk about a trial on whether Wisconsin's Republican-drawn legislative districts are too gerrymandered and a violation of voting rights. Right now, here's a few headlines with Peter Bryant. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, records show the incoming superintendent at the Lincoln Hills Schools for Boys had red flags in his employment history. We'll check in with a reporter about that and other latest news from the troubled youth prison in northern Wisconsin, which is now caught up in a federal probe.
Right now, we're turning our attention to an ongoing battle over voting districts in Wisconsin. Yesterday, a panel of federal judges started hearing a lawsuit arguing that the legislative districts that were drawn after the state's 2010 census are heavily skewed.
Several Democrats argue that the Republican-drawn districts are so partisan that they violate voting rights. Barry Burden joins us now. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the UW's Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, in past cases in courts involving so-called gerrymandering, what has that meant? What constitutes gerrymandering, according to the courts?
Well, it's a moving target. The courts generally don't like to wade into cases that seem to be just about partisanship, but they have defined districts as either illegal or inappropriate if they violate voting rights for minority groups or other terms. And so this case is really being watched nationwide because it's about partisanship, and that would set a new precedent.
Yeah, the argument being made here, and there's some academic research on the mathematics behind this, I think, the argument is that Republicans didn't just gerrymander, they didn't just stack things in their own benefit, which parties do on both sides around the country, but they went above and beyond past levels of partisan districts. What's the case being made here?
Yeah, the unique thing about this case is that there's a measure being offered, something called the efficiency gap that the plaintiffs have created, and it's a metric that would determine when districts have become so bad that they're beyond the threshold that's acceptable. And this is something that Supreme Court justices have said in previous cases they're looking for. They want to know where that line is, and here the plaintiffs have actually measured the efficiency gap in Wisconsin in recent years, but also in a bunch of other states and over time, to show just where today's maps stand relative to other maps.
And what do we mean by an efficiency gap? What does that mean in terms of people's votes being meaningful or meaningless?
Well, it's a measure essentially of how many votes are wasted, either wasted by packing supporters of one group into an area, and so they have excess votes, or spreading them out so thinly that they don't have influence in any one district. And in Wisconsin, it appears as though Republicans have done a good job at maximizing the number of seats they get from the votes they earn. I think for the last two election cycles here in Wisconsin, the assembly has been above 10% on the efficiency gap measure, which would mean that Republicans are getting about 10% more in seats than they would deserve based on votes alone.
Part of this is a story about technology, as I understand it. In the old days, if you wanted to draw districts, you had a big map, and you had pencils, and I guess erasers, too, and you did the best you could. Now we have computers, and you can run hundreds or even thousands of different maps to find the best one.
That's right. And so each wave, every 10 years when this map making is done, is a little more sophisticated with more consultants and more software and more techniques in play. And here there was also secrecy involved, and that's part of the case, that a lot of this was done off of state property in a private law firm. And so the case really has two elements. One is the efficiency gap measure and whether the majority Republicans went too far, and the other is the process by which those maps were drawn.
Right. In some cases, lawmakers had to sign a secrecy agreement with a law firm, as I understand it, to look at their own potential district.
That's my understanding, and it was
that's the testimony in court anyway, yeah.
That's right, and I think there was also an allegation that it was a private law firm doing this work off of state property, so there's some question about open meetings requirements and so on.
Talking to Barry Burden from UW-Madison about a court case involving redistricting here in Wisconsin, the latest district boundaries drawn, Democrats saying it's violating people's voting rights. What has been the argument from the state, in effect, as represented, I think, by the Attorney General's office?
Yeah, the defense is essentially saying this is just partisanship. It's what parties do when they get into power. They draw maps to try to help themselves out. We've seen Democrats and Republicans do this in states across the country. This one may be a little more extreme than others, but it's within the bounds of what's acceptable. There's no violation of Voting Rights Act or any other federal statute, and so what's the case?
But there was one smaller challenge to the redistricting involving Latino voters and districts. That would be a more traditional court challenge over gerrymandering, wouldn't it?
That's right. And this becomes difficult for the public to track because there are so many lawsuits happening in such a short period of time. But you're right, within this cycle, since these maps were adopted, there were suits dealing with a couple of districts in the Milwaukee area. This is really a suit about the entire map.
This is something that could end up going, as you alluded to earlier, to the U.S. Supreme Court. Are we maybe setting precedent here in Wisconsin for the way lines are drawn all over the country?
That could happen. This is the furthest any case of this type has gotten. To have a three-court panel hear it that involves both federal court judges and appeals court judges. It could go directly to the Supreme Court on appeal from here. Justice Kennedy, who's the swing vote on the court, at least when there are nine members, has said he's looking for a standard. He wants to know what metric, what threshold to use, and here this case is offering it.
There have been calls over the years to change the way we draw these maps here in Wisconsin and not have it in the hand of the political parties. Sometimes by default, if we have split government, Republicans in the Assembly, Democrats in the Senate, it ends up in court hands often anyway. But right now it's winner take all if you win both houses. Both parties have had a chance to change this when they've had full majorities. The Democrats didn't change it. The Republicans didn't change it. Do you think there's an appetite, though, to take it out of partisan hands in Wisconsin?
There has been some movement to do that. There have been bills in the legislature essentially to adopt the model that's used in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Iowa has the opposite system in a way. It's a nonpartisan system where state agencies are tasked with drawing maps, and they hand them to the legislature for an up or down vote. And those maps are drawn without regard to partisanship and without regard to where incumbents live. So it tends to be a more efficient, more inexpensive, and more transparent system. The state, for a variety of reasons, has resisted that over the decades.
I won't ask you to predict what this particular federal court is going to rule on this, or the Supreme Court for that matter, but what's the crux, do you think, that the judges are going to be weighing? What are they going to really be looking for to make their decision?
I think one is whether they can trust this new measure, whether they believe it's actually capturing the thing that the plaintiffs allege. And then two, if they believe that the measure is valid, is Wisconsin far enough over the line to say that these maps need to be struck down?
And then if they agree that the maps need to be struck down, I guess what is the usual court remedy? Does that mean the courts redraw the map, or do they send it back to the legislature? What happens to solve this problem if the courts say, yeah, this is a problem?
It could be any of those options, really. It may be a message to the legislature, you need to draw new maps that have a better efficiency measure, or it could mean that the courts get involved and try to draw the maps themselves.
We'll be watching this. I'm sure you will, too. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Glad to be here.
We've been talking to Barry Burton. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the UW's Elections Research Center. He talked to us about this ongoing trial just started this week over the state's redistricting map drawn by the Republican majority in the legislature. Democrats saying that the Republican-drawn map violates voting rights. You can follow this. We'll post updates on the Central Time Facebook page. On Monday, we talked about the sighting of a giant snake, possibly a python, people said, in the Dickeyville area in southwestern Wisconsin. A Facebook post from the Grant County Sheriff's Department said the snake had been described as being as long as the width of two lanes of traffic.
At least one snake expert was a little skeptical at that point, but as it turns out, the giant snake of Grant County, maybe not such a giant. Someone managed to get a picture of this snake, and it's now been identified as a bull snake. This is a native snake to the area, not like a python, and it's estimated to be somewhere between 4 and 6 feet long. Not even one lane of traffic, but still, this is a big snake.
Pretty big. Well, a quick science update based on 2 minutes of internet research. A bull snake is a non-venomous constrictor type of snake, and it's viewed as being bad-tempered and defensive if you bother it, so don't, but it plays a valuable role in controlling populations of rodents and other mammal vermin by eating them.
In Grant County, one piece of advice remains the same. The sheriff department originally said, don't touch it, we have a plan for apprehending the snake. Well, now it's just, if you see the snake, leave it alone.
Leave it alone. I'm all for that. Leave the angry, large, still pretty large snake alone.
The ill-tempered and defensive snake.
And let it do its business there in Grant County. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.